Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a four-month process that included a tour of four early primary states to pitch his dignity of work message, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown yesterday announced that he will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. But he told reporters on Thursday he got his fellow Democrats talking about the message.
Not only are other candidates starting to talk about the dignity of work, voters across the country are demanding it from the farmers we met in Iowa in 15-degree below zero weather to the child care workers we met in New Hampshire.
We're talking about the news of Brown's decision and the outlook for Democrats today. Joining us by phone is Chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, David Pepper. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Did you talk to Senator Brown during the time he was considering a run?
You know, we exchanged a few messages, but I'd never talked to him directly about it. And he was obviously very busy with the tour.
What did you make of his pitch on the dignity of work?
You know, I actually think he, especially knowing that he's now not running, I actually think he did an enormous service to the other candidates. Because what he did was, project to them, if you want to win a state like Ohio or some of these Midwestern states, Here's the way you should be framing things so you can do so. And as he said, you just played the recording. I did see myself several of the candidates start to pivot around his type of messaging. And as he showed last November, and frankly as he's shown his whole career, when you really are kind of all in for the worker, and that's the first priority you set as someone in public service, it really helps you win places like Ohio that are otherwise tough to win. So I think the tour he did was a really, frankly, it ends up being a service to the other Democrats who are all looking at places like Ohio and other states that Trump won and wondering how do we win them back.
What's your reaction to his decision?
You know, I think I'll just speak more broadly. I think that there were a lot of Democrats in Ohio very excited for him to run, so some are disappointed. I think others, though, were concerned that we'd lose a Democratic senator that's been our champion for a long time. So I think it's sort of a mixed response from what I can tell. I think we will now have obviously someone very dedicated to making sure that Ohio is blue in 20, which I think is possible if we do things right, if we have the right candidates. So I think having him, in Ohio plugging away every day is a big help to make sure that we get things we need to get done in Ohio done. But I think it's a mix. I think there were many people that were excited both in Ohio and beyond at the prospect of him running, and obviously those folks are disappointed.
Well, obviously, having someone like Sherrod Brown, the most prominent elected Democrat in the state, would energize that base that has frankly not been real good about getting out and voting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, November we had probably mm-hmm. the best midterm turnout we've ever seen, and our hope is to lift that even more in 20. And without Sherrod, obviously, our hope is that the ticket coming together will be able to do the same thing. Now, I will tell you, looking at the candidates running and some who are going to run, there's a lot of discussion about, is it too many and is it fractured? I think it's an incredibly talented group of people who are stepping up to run for president. And I'm confident that whatever combination ends up being the ticket will also be able to inspire Ohioans to show up in big numbers like they did in 8 and 12.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio, of course, announced yesterday that he will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. We're talking about, the fallout from that. And what about the party going forward? My guest right now, David Pepper, he's chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear what you think about Sherrod Brown's decision. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Speaking of that combination on the at the top of the ticket. What about his prospects as a running mate?
I would think if he's interested, he'd obviously be one of the top, two or three people to be considered. I mean, one reason I think it was obviously very credible for him to look to run for president was if you're a Democrat and you won Ohio by 7 points, you obviously have something special going on. And I think the people who ultimately, whoever wins the nomination, whether or not Sherrod says I'm interested, I think he'll get a very strong look. I think he was one of the finalists last time, and I think he'll be that again this time.
What, besides if he joining a ticket, by the way, notable yesterday, he did not endorse anybody else. But what can he do from the sidelines at this point?
You know, one of the most amazing things, if you were watching yesterday, was within minutes of making this announcement, he was on the Senate floor really fired up about some of these right-wing judges they just pushed through. So I think the first thing is just to continue to be the great senator that he is. He has a unique voice, not just because he represents Ohio, but because he represents workers. And he's just able to bridge a lot of the divisions in our party right now. You know, and I think the first thing is to continue to be just an outstanding senator, and he showed yesterday that he's fired up to do that. But I do think, you know, he will be sought after in a major way from these presidential candidates. And to the extent he doesn't announce early, I think that's actually a good thing, because my hope is that they will listen to him when it comes to how do you win a state like Ohio, how do you focus on issues, how do you personify an approach that gets you to cross over and win some voters here that have in the last 20 years gone back and forth. So I think he'll be someone whose counsel will be sought by all these candidates, and my hope is they listen to him. Obviously, last November and prior elections show that he knows how to get it done in states like this, and if we're going to win back the presidency, it's going to be through the Midwest.
You mentioned the divisions in the party. It's a party very much in flux. Now, you know, there was a lot of success at the ballot box in November. Obviously, there often is for the other party from the sitting president. But it also brought into greater relief the divisions in the party. That's much you know, the people that were voted in is a very diverse freshman class from the Democrats, but it's also much more polarized in the past. You said he can bridge divisions. Why do you think that he can do that?
I mean, and this is one of the appeals when he was talking about running, is there is this long-term, you know, suggested division between, you know, going for your blue-collar worker voters versus your more progressive voters, and shared someone who's always been able to bridge that. I mean, he does not pull his punches on any issues. He is who he is, but he also is a very outspoken champion for blue-collar workers who struggle in places like we're seeing today in Lordstown. And he's been able to do it really without any trouble at all, in a way that others maybe can't. So I think his you know, to the extent that others looking to run for president can learn from that, they should, and I think he'll help them do that. And I think it starts with what he talks about, which is, you know, it starts out with the dignity of work and hard work, hard workers, and that if you work hard, you should get ahead. And if that's your core principle, a lot of people will gravitate towards that, even if they don't agree with everything else you stand for. And basically, and one thing that I think he's been very smart to say is this isn't a slogan, and those in Ohio know that. This has been his career, decades of doing it, of personifying it, and the hope, again, is as others seek his support, that they'll learn from him, and a lot of the way he operates will rub off on them. I mean, and it ends up being something that comes through, you know, things that he'll notice and pick up on, like the tip jar, I think, at United Airlines, or the fact that baseball was considering not using union-made baseball caps. I mean, he is so attentive to these issues that it comes up in ways that are way beyond what the usual political person even thinks of. And the hope is that ends up being something that other candidates learn from as they compete for the next year.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been given a lot of credit for a certain level of authenticity.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I've been to many events with Sherrod Brown. There has not ever been an event where he is not thanking the folks serving the meal as the first thing he does. I think he'll take the time to talk to everybody, not just the big shots in the room. And so it's just who he is. And again, as you asked, to the extent others are seeking his support, my hope is that they'll learn from a lot of that, because that's how he's an interest. I've also run statewide, and I learned very early on, I would hear often from people who weren't necessarily Democrats, well, I don't agree with Sherrod on everything, but he says what he thinks, and I know who he's fighting for. And that's what he's always been about, and my hope is that, and that's, I think, how you win a state like Ohio, where you have certainly some fired-up Democrats, you have some fired-up Republicans, but you got a whole lot of people in the middle who kind of go back and forth depending on the person who's on the ballot. And I think other candidates could learn a lot from his style of authenticity.
He pretty much reigns alone as the sole Democrat to be elected statewide, I guess, since 2011, something like that. Are you worried about your bench and that people, you know, they're not getting the foothold that they need to start building, a farm team even at this point?
You know, I actually think that the truth is, I think we have a very strong bench. I think you saw it last November. We had a wonderful set of statewide candidates. They didn't win. They ran the closest races together that we've run since 06. But overall, you know, one of the real issues when it comes to Ohio politics is gerrymandering. And the best way you build your bench is usually through congressional offices. If you have enough people in Congress, that's sort of the middle step mm-hmm. that it takes to run statewide. And when you have gerrymandering, so you only have four members of Congress basically guaranteed, it does hurt your ability to lift up. You know, we have a lot of good mayors. We have a lot of good state representatives and state senators. We have a lot of good county leaders. A lot of them make the run for statewide. But without that congressional, without really opportunities to run for Congress, it does cut off the ability to go, you know, to go sort of a middle step before you run statewide. So we have a great group of Democrats. You know, I think the talent of the Democrats, if you look into the last November's election, obviously the results were what they were. But in terms of the capabilities of the folks running, we had incredibly talented people. But I do think this the gerrymandering, which thanks to the citizens and the constitutional amendment we passed, will be much better. The districts will be much fairer after 20. Should help us highlight this bench a lot more than we're able to right now. But we work. By the way, we work very hard as a party. 2 weeks ago, we had 130 people that we were training to run for local office this November. So we work very hard on building that bench. The current Democratic leadership at the State House, I think, is very strong, and we have a whole next generation of mayors leading around the state. We have mayors of the 14 biggest cities of Ohio. But I do think the jump statewide is one that's the toughest, and obviously that's the one that we've got work to do on.
Are you comfortable that the diversity that's emerging on the national scene in the Democratic primary field is reflected in Ohio? Or when you're talking about all those mayors, I know there's the Nan Whaleys out there of Dayton and that kind of a thing, but what is your sense about the diversity? Is it reflected in Ohio in the Democratic Party?
Look at our new minority leader and Amelia Sykes mm-hmm. and her new leadership team. I think is 3 out of 4 are women. Half of our Democratic caucus now, for the first time in history, is made up of women. We ran last election, unlike the Republicans, I think 10 of our 16 congressional candidates were women, and about half of our state house candidates were women. So I actually think we are. Generally, and it's a big, I'm glad you asked, it's a very important goal of ours. In the last couple of years, we've placed a huge priority on this. We've been electing far more young people to office in our local offices. We've elected far more openly LGBTQ candidates, and women were the leading force of our state house wins last November. You know, we flipped 6 seats. We hadn't flipped one house seat the entire decade. We flipped mm-hmm. 6, and it's not an accident that 4 of the 6 were women. So I we've worked very hard on that, and we'll obviously keep doing that.
David Pepper, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on. Talk to you soon.
You bet. David Pepper, chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party. Coming up, we're going to get some more feedback and reaction. We want to hear from you about Sherrod Brown's decision not to seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. You can call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown yesterday announced that he will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020.
once the dignity of work began to kind of, once we were thinking about going on that tour and figuring this out, starting at Christmas, we really wrestled with this. I made the ultimate decision yesterday. That's when we decided to have this call.
Senator Brown's announcement came as something of surprise to the many who assumed that the time invested in his Dignity of Work campaign, traveling to four early primary states in the dead of winter, strongly suggested otherwise. We're talking about the Brown decision and the outlook for Democrats heading into the presidential campaign cycle. Joining us, Ohio State Assistant Professor of Political Science, Thomas Wood. Welcome back.
Hi.
And also Ohio Wesleyan University Assistant Professor of Politics and Government, Brianna Mack. Welcome
Hi.
Back. And by phone, Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau reporter Jessica Wehrman. Welcome back, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
So, were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought he was all in.
Yeah.
I mean, every sign seemed to point to yes. You know, he traveled the states. He seemed to have a pretty good experience. Now, I was not able to travel with him, so I don't know how enthusiastically or not enthusiastic the crowds were for him. But it looked like, in many respects, his time had come. And by that, I mean, I felt like the environment was right for him to run. I don't know if he would have won or not, but it was kind of a good year for him to be who he was and potentially running. So I was surprised. But,
what about the environment was right? What do you mean by that?
So he is an interesting, you know, the day before he decided not to run, or I guess it was the day he decided to run, but he announced it one day later.
Mm-hmm.
I spent the day looking at every single clip I could get my mitts on about him in anticipation. If he ran, I would be able to pop out a big profile of him or what have you.
Mm-hmm. You make it look easy, Jessica.
Well, I mean, I have covered him since 2006 when he first ran for senator against Mike DeWine. So I didn't know, you know, the period of time when he was Secretary of State. And I had to do some research on it. Mm-hmm. And what struck me as interesting was that when he was first elected as a statewide official, this was a very Democratic state. Ohio, like, everyone was Democrat.
Yeah.
You couldn't find a Republican if you look. But over time, the state evolved into a much more Republican state. And what's interesting is, as the state grew more Republican, he still kept winning. He's only lost one race in his entire life, and this is a man who's been in public service since 1975.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a good moment for him. For some reason, he's been able to talk to a Republican state as a Democrat successfully for decades, which if you are in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Michigan, states that have traditionally been Democratic but have evolved into a Republican state, I think that someone like Brown could be appealing. Just, you know, the talk that he talks, the walk that he walks, sort of the populist rhetoric. I think there would have been a window for him in the state to do the very thing that Trump did in 2016, which was win the state.
So one more question before I move to our other guest. But why do you think he decided against it? I mean, we know what he says, and I don't doubt.
So,
but
yeah, and I don't know. I mean, you know, here's what he insisted had nothing to do with it. He insisted it didn't have to do with money. He insisted it didn't have to do with the fact that, you know, you've got Joe Biden also doing that sort of working class lane. But this had to have been factors. And, you know, he is a progressive who has managed to hang on to his seat in Ohio for decades. So there has to be a pragmatic bone in his body that says, okay, here's the political reality on the ground. He's not Don Quixote. He's not going to tilt at a windmill. He's going to do this. If he thinks he can do it. So mm-hmm. I don't know what exactly it was. And he also says, you know, he never really wanted to do this. He wanted to be a center fielder for the Cleveland Indians. He never wanted to be a president. But I think that there were probably political reality factors that probably weighed in. Even whether or not he admits it or not, I'm sure that there were some practicalities that, you know, played a role.
Brianna Mack, what do you make of it?
So when I heard that he decided not to run, I was shocked. I was a little disappointed because it seemed as if he was one, if we also include Biden, maybe I think they are the two candidates that could actually unify the party and actually put up a strong chance against Trump. So, but the explanation he gave about, well, someone has to stay in the Senate, it makes complete sense. I mean, because what excluding him, there's six senators running. That's 6% of the Senate.
And not all of them from a safe seat, am I right? I mean, some of them are from are running, would be running in a year, they'd be up for reelection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you have six senators that are also running for president, which means the Senate is 6% also, you know, less effective, less productive. And so that makes perfect sense. And so perhaps maybe he's looking at the bigger picture and saying, well, hey, if I did run for president, the governor will, and I won, the governor will have to appoint my replacement, which means that it will be a Republican, which makes Ohio more red, and then also would decrease his ability to be effective. And so, like, I think he's also, what, ranking member or the chairperson of the banking committee on the Senate?
Yes, ranking member.
Yeah. And so I think he believes he can do more as a senator and as a higher ranking senator.
Yeah. Thomas Wood, I mean, what's your reaction?
I think it's interesting what it says about the new media environment. Insofar as if we were to design a table which blanked out the names but just listed candidates by their attributes, mm-hmm. you'd think a candidate with his sort of mix of attributes would be pretty well suited, like way to the left of the Democratic Party for decades and decades, has won in the kind of state which is not an easy place for the blue team to win, you know, doesn't just rack up the score in California or Massachusetts, has demonstrated a capacity to appeal to, like, low-propensity Democratic voters. And I think it suggests something about the way the media environment has changed the way that parties nominate candidates, insofar as if this was 25, 30 years ago, a candidate who has tremendous institutional bona fides and is a reliable ideological soldier would carry a bunch of institutional endorsements by the time that the American public sort of turned their attention.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, he would be presented as the guy who the institutional other office holders and other institutional resources have said, this is the guy who's going to be our sort of banner holder. But instead, he's now looking at this field where for the next year, he'll be up against a bunch of people who are probably a little bit more shrewd about how to present themselves as fiery Democratic candidates, a guy who that's probably not doesn't resound to his strengths. So in that environment, I think he's looking down the road. It's going to be a pretty tough year between now and then. Just look at the polling. A bunch of the polls that have been put out so far haven't even included him as an option.
Right.
He's coming from a tremendous, like, disadvantage from that perspective.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fallout from the decision or the announcement yesterday by U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio to not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. You just heard from Thomas Wood. He's an assistant professor of political science at Ohio State. Also with us, Brianna Mack. She's an assistant professor of politics and government at Ohio Wesleyan University. And by phone, Jessica Wehrman, Washington Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Want to hear what you think? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Fred from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I'd just like to know what your panel thinks. I'm kind of glad that Sherrod Brown didn't run. And as a lifelong Republican in Ohio who no longer see a fit for me in that party, what do you think about Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke running? Because I think the candidates that are out there now are kind of diluted. And I don't think that someone of the older generation that who is looking for a reason to vote Democratic would gravitate to any of the candidates that are out there right now.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that therein lies that whole issue of the division in the party and how it's become more polarized. Jessica Wehrman, what about the metrics of Joe Biden, for starters?
You know, the interesting thing here is there is, and I think Trump demonstrated this very well, there is something to be said for being known. And I think that was actually a liability for Brown. He's very well known in this state. People have been voting for him for years, but he's not necessarily known nationwide. I mean, you may not, if you're not paying attention to politics, you might not know who he is.
Right.
Biden is known. You cannot make the argument that he is not known. And you kind of know what you're going to get with him because he's been around forever. You know, we've had him as vice president, obviously. So I think that actually provides sort of a built-in advantage. You'll remember, Donald Trump did not have to. He was not the guy who raised the most money in the Republican primary last
time. He didn't have to.
He didn't have to. He was known. And I think, we were talking about the changing environment, the media environment. There is something to be said for being a household name. Regardless of what your own politics are, regardless of where you stand on this issue or that issue, people like familiarity.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that the Beto O'Rourke thing and Joe Biden. Okay, so here's the thing that the Democrats are wrestling with. You've got kind of an old school establishment group, and then you've got kind of these young insurgents. You've got the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You've got Beto, who is new or newer, relatively speaking. And then you've got sort of these institutions. I mean, they really are kind of in sort of a little bit of an identity crisis mm-hmm. right now as to who's going to lead the party going forward. Is it going to be these folks who have been well-established, who have obviously built strong careers, but they, you know, their faces that are very, very familiar to people for good or for bad, and they as a result, they're kind of polarizing. Or are they going to be these new folks who are similarly polarizing for different reasons? That's something they really have to wrestle with. And when you've got a cast of 14 wrestling for the role of, like, you know, the guy, or the gal, then that's really something that has to be, you know, that's going to be have to be something that they figure out going forward.
You know, I figure, you know, when Fred mentioned Beto and the vice president, whose name is just
Biden,
Joe Biden. I mean, you've got the old and the new. You've got the coastal elite, if you will, and you've got Texas. Beto O'Rourke did a very good showing in Texas.
You know what you don't have? Industrial Midwest.
Right. Thank you. Exactly. But you don't have that with many of the other candidates either. Right, Brianna Mack?
Yeah, that's true. But
that's one of the things that Sherrod Brown did bring to the table for sure.
And that was going to be a big plus. And I guess if it does turn out that Biden will run, I guess we'll say, well, since he does have a relationship or past with workers, that perhaps it would resound in the Midwest.
Maybe.
We'll be optimistic.
Yeah. What do you think, Thomas Wood?
So being known is obviously a huge advantage to polling well now. We should probably keep in mind that the Jeb Bush was pretty well known. Is the last time he was among the most famous American pollsters. Hillary Clinton was pretty well known in 2007. So I think it's
in and of itself, that's not enough.
Well, I mean, it's something. But I think we should keep in mind that over the next year, this will get very, very fraught. It's not going to be resolved peacefully. And it's not going to be resolved probably on policy grounds. So that the fight inside the party will turn on a fairly acrimonious personal set of, like, spite and performance, these debates. So did Sherrod Brown have an appetite for that? Like, I certainly wouldn't. And so figuring out who will be best at subtly denigrating his or her opponents, that's a very, like, specific political skill that people don't like to advertise about themselves.
Well, and it can do a lot of damage. I mean, I don't think it's done the Republican Party any favors since the 2016 race. What do you think, Brianna Mack?
It really hasn't, but I will give it to the Republican Party that even after Trump secured the nomination, there seemed to be at least as an outsider looking at the party, that they somehow managed to unite, put up a united front, and secure the presidency. Mm-hmm. What I'm concerned about for the Democratic Party is with all of these different candidates representing different aspects, different niches, if you will, and then Sherrod Brown deciding not to run, that means we have now all of these niche candidates, and if one of these candidates does secure the nomination, what does this mean for the larger party? Will these certain pockets that did not get their person as the nominee, will they feel isolated? Will they choose not to vote? I think there are some issues going on within the party that needs to be worked out.
Well, and there was a similar disaffection in the race, the Democrats, with Bernie Sanders ilk and the Hillary Rodham Clinton ilk. What do you think, Jessica Wehrman? I mean, can they wind up with something that'll pull the party together and light a fire on the base and get people to the ballot box? Because that's another issue that Democrats have that Republicans don't usually.
And that's going to be the sort of wrestling match. Because right now, you know, they're like in a race to see who can go the farthest left. And actually, Sherrod Brown, one of the more progressive senators in the Senate, Nobody's ever called him a righty. He was kind of a potential centrist candidate. He didn't necessarily embrace Medicare for All. He thought it had to be more of an incremental thing, starting with 50 or, you know.
Again, that pragmatism coming in. Yeah.
It was pragmatic. And I think if you're trying to win swing states, if you're racing as far to the left as humanly possible, I don't think that wins voters who are necessarily in Ohio who say, well, I don't really love Trump, but wow, this is pretty aggressive. So that's going to have to be, they're going to have to find a candidate in order to win the White House. They're going to have to find a candidate who can win some of these Trump voters who might be a little bit freaked out by, you know, super, super new left proposal, like the new Green Deal. I mean, that might alienate some of the very voters that they're trying to win in 2020.
We are talking about prospects for Democrats going into 2020. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown announced yesterday that he would not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. We're talking about what's left. You just heard from Jessica Wehrman. She's Washington Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Brianna Mack. She's an assistant professor of politics and government at Ohio Wesleyan University. And also Thomas Wood, assistant professor of political science at Ohio State. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown announced yesterday that he will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. And that means we have a lot to talk about when it comes to who will get the nomination to go up against what is probably expected to be Donald Trump. Still with us, OSU Assistant Professor of Political Science, Thomas Wood, Assistant Professor of Politics and Government at Ohio Wesleyan University, Brianna Mack, and by phone, Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau reporter Jessica Wehrman. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jessica Wehrman, we were just talking off the air about, you know, how the party has changed since 2016 and how Bernie Sanders is saying, hey, I got the ball rolling. I'm the one that got the conversation started about Medicare for All and those kinds of things, bringing out in the party its far left leanings, although he's not technically a member of the party, be that as it may, he will seek the Democratic nomination again. What do you make of the Bernie Sanders piece in all of this?
I think back in 2016, part of the feedback or part of Sanders' appeal was the fact that he was new to, and he's been around forever, but he was new to these guys. I mean, when he was out in Iowa, that was the first time many people were encountering Bernie Sanders. When he was in New Hampshire, same thing. I mean, there was sort of a fresh face to him as opposed to Clinton, who had, I guess, provoked a level of fatigue because she's been in the public sphere for a very long time. It is kind of a fine line because, you know, I was just talking earlier about sort of the need to really be well-known, but there is such a thing as being too well-known. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember in 2016 going to a Bernie Sanders rally, and it was packed. I mean, there were all these people. But you know what? Halfway through, they started leaving because he kind of went on. I mean, went on for quite a bit. And I thought that was kind of fat. I mean, it's one thing to pack the House, but it's another thing to make them stick. And I think to many of the voters in Iowa at the time, that many of the Democratic voters who were excited about him, you know, after they listened to him for a while, I don't know that the attraction was necessarily there as much. Now, he did perform very well in those caucuses, mm-hmm. but there is, you know, you still have to kind of have sort of a general appeal that people will go, okay, I mean, you want free college for all. That's fantastic. How do you pay for it?
Mm-hmm. Again, that pragmatic piece. Brianna Mack, I mean, do you think he stays in the field? Do you think he sticks with it? And what do you think his chances are this time around?
Well, I hate to say it, but I don't think Bernie will secure the nomination in 2020 either. I think at this point he is here just as a personality figure or just a representative of these ideals, or encouraging the party to just accept these new ideas, because I'm also not convinced that even though the Democratic Party has accepted all of the, well, not accepted, but incorporated all of these new platforms that, you know, Bernie has introduced, I think they're just doing that just as an attempt to try to mobilize all of Bernie's supporters. And my concern is when Bernie does not secure the nomination, we will see the same demobilization that we saw in 2016.
What do you think, Thomas Wood?
So on the negative side, faces the same demographic challenge that Sherrod Brown faces, you know, a party that's very motivated by questions of racial equity, you know, like a 70-year-old white guy is probably not the best exemplar for that policy position, except, gosh, a money machine. The guy has demonstrated a really incredible capacity to generate resources. And so it seems imprudent to bet against him insofar as he will be able to go for as long as he deems necessary. And in a very crowded field where by the time you start voting next year, the Democratic rules are not designed to come up with a winner early. You know, like, uh-huh. And so a person who can stick around like that, he'll be in the right place. And if we're coming into June next year and like eight different candidates have all won primaries, you know, like being able to stick around for a long time with a lot of money will be a real advantage.
I agree. If it comes around next year and we have 7 or 8 different candidates all winning different primaries and caucuses, well, that means that indicates that the party is alive and that they're working through these issues. I would be very happy to see something like that.
614.
This whole conversation is giving me post-traumatic stress 2016. Like, well, people on the Republican stage. Oh, it was a little overwhelming.
Well, I am. It'll be very interesting to see the first debate in June. And how they manage the crowds on the stage, that kind of a thing. Let's see. Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
I want to step away from politics for a second and say how important I think it is for someone with Senator Brown's intelligence and understanding of finance, and as far as I know, dedication to the public interest in Washington. And if I can step back to the 2008-2009 meltdown of the American economy, I happen to have a lot of time to be sitting listening to my car radio and probably heard about 100 times as much commentary as the average American. And it was such a relief to me at that time because, you know, most of the politicians I could tell really didn't know what was going on. And Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts, whom I think was heading one of the House financial committees, just really seemed to have some understanding of what was going on. And I would sit and say, oh, thank goodness. And again, from a nonpartisan point of view, someone has some expertise. And this just seems to be so lost in either party in our electoral process right now.
And do you think Sherrod Brown would brings that to the table in the Senate?
Yes, or to whatever he serves at in Washington. When I hear him speak, I think he understands what is going on and has a level of intelligence. And even, you know, for a long time he's been way alone on trade. And
not anymore.
I've been
big guys on his side,
right? And I've been sort of with him. And I heard, I can't remember if it's Larry Summers or who, come around this year, you know, after President Trump run and say, well, gee, maybe we economists did get it wrong. Trade is good in the aggregate, but maybe it hasn't distributed the wealth right. And I'm thinking, yeah, finally, you know.
Okay.
And so, yes, I think Sherrod brings some intelligence.
Well, thanks a lot, Mary, for that call. Appreciate it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So that's Mary responding to the fact that she's saying that she's kind of glad Sherrod Brown is staying in the Senate, that he's needed there. I was kind of wondering what you think he can do from the sidelines, Jessica Wehrman.
I mean, he actually made this argument a little bit on the call yesterday, mm-hmm. which was that there were things he was able to push as a member of the U.S. Senate that he was able to accomplish because he was in the Senate as opposed to, I don't know, the White House or somewhere else, I suppose, and that he can sort of keep advocating, keep advocating. The interesting thing I found was that moments after he got on this conference call and said, you know, I'm not doing this, I'm not going to run for president, he went out on the Senate floor and he gave a very impassioned speech against the federal judge nominee. It was marked in sort of the passion and sort of the level of, I guess, fight in it. And so when he said he was going to be a fighter, he basically tried to go out afterwards and immediately make that case. So there are things. When he became the ranking Democrat on the banking committee, bigger banks sort of said, "Oh my gosh, this is our nightmare." Having Sherrod Brown, you know, who is, you know, fights for more regulation and that sort of thing on the as a head Democrat on this panel. So mm-hmm. when he says he can make a difference in the U.S. Senate, I mean, there is something to be said for that, and it is true. You know, you can't. I mean, there is a legacy that you can create as a member of the U.S. Senate. I'm not sure, that's why he says, and he also says he finds joy in that job. And I think, you know, there is something to be said for that, as opposed to embarking on, I don't know what, a 2-year-long slog of campaign events and trying to raise money yeah. and doing this or that. And then at the end of the day, maybe you win, but maybe you don't. So actually, Rob Portman said the same thing when he was considering running back in 2016. He said, you know, I feel like I can make a difference in the Senate. I don't know. You know, I haven't asked him recently whether he still thinks that's the case or not, but I guess I would be curious to find out.
If you had to pick, I mean, if he's still in the running, he's wisely, people saying, staying out of the fray at this point, not endorsing anybody. I think David Pepper, the Democratic Party chair in Ohio, said more people will listen to him the longer he stays out of it, in a way. But do you, any of you, see him in a matchup with anybody? We've already heard the prospect for a Biden-Beto matchup. What do you think, Brianna Mack? Does he fit with anybody as a running mate?
As I'm sitting here thinking about it, like, the first thing I thought was Elizabeth Warren, yeah. but...
Or Kamala Harris, maybe? Yeah, like...
I'm not on the Kamala Harris train, so
he's good friends with her though.
Yeah. And geographic diversity, right. Racial diversity, gender diversity seems a bit elegant,
right? You see him with a female at the top of the ticket, more likely.
I think particularly if there's someone who is a minority or a woman on the top right. of the ticket, I think he'd be. And quite frankly, they would be really wise to consider him. He said he was not interested in it, but
well, they always say that.
I cannot help. Well, yeah, I mean, if you offered me the job of, I don't know, CEO of something or other, gee, I hadn't been considering it before, but now, you know, what's the pay? I just think with him, I think 2016 might have turned out a little bit differently if they'd been able to speak to the Midwestern voters in a way that they were unable to. I mean, look at that. If Trump loses Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, all industrial Midwestern, well, then if he loses those states, he loses the White House.
Yeah. So, well, let's see. Ed in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
I just wanted to add an observation to the conversation and get the thoughts of your guests. Chris Matthews used to say that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And it just the observation I've seen is when Democrats nominate a candidate that's the outsider, they tend to be more successful, whether that was Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. Barack Obama, the fresh face. But when Democrats nominated the establishment candidate, they weren't so successful, whether it was Walter Mondale or John Kerry, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton. Whoever that was, but we tend to do better when we nominate somebody that is that fresh face, that outsider. I think you even saw it with the Bernie Sanders phenomenon in 2016, that he was that fresh face and the Democratic voters mm-hmm. fell in love and wanted to, he might have been the better nominee, but I just wanted to get a sense of what your guests might think of that observation.
What do you think, Thomas Wood? Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, I think Republicans fall in line. I think we can safely shelve that aphorism. You know, the guy they just nominated didn't have a single elite endorsement. I hesitate to make pattern recognition on the last couple of elections and safely conclude that it was insider-outsider. you know, as we just heard, you know, Donald Trump came 77,000 votes in three states to losing the last election. Hillary Clinton amassed amassed millions more votes. I think all candidates will very wisely position themselves as outsiders just because of the popular sort of moment we're in. But I think it's a very complicated process to boil it down to one dimension.
What do you think, Brianna?
Well, I was sitting here thinking about it. All of these Democratic candidates are portraying themselves to be outsiders. And so when you said that, the first thing I said is everybody can't be on the outside. Somebody has to be on the inside. And I think perhaps maybe since everyone's portraying themselves to be on the outside, if Biden does run and then portrays himself as being an insider, well, we're just going to pick the one person that seems different because he is the different one because he's the insider.
Okay. Huh. Interesting. Dan in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm a moderate, and my family comes where, like, blue-collar for the most part. But we did vote. Most of us voted for Trump the last election. But, like, right now, I think the biggest issue for the Democrats is if they can work to unify and kind of stay moderate, because some of the agendas, like you guys mentioned, like the Green New Deal, college for all, health care for all, is something that a lot of voters who really care about economics, kind of like I do, is are they going to vote for a good economy, which we're kind of in right now, versus extreme deals? And I'm looking to see if the Democrats can find someone like a Joe Biden that people know that aren't going to go too far left or too far right with ideas.
All right. So what about that? You know, you're here. Dan, would you vote for Trump again?
If it was versus Bernie Sanders or someone like if Cortez ran and like or if
someone far left, yeah,
I would vote for Trump. But if there's like a Biden on the table or a someone that kind of like a Bill Clinton, I would vote the Democratic side.
OK, thanks for the call. So two different perspectives. Jessica Wehrman, what do you think?
You know, I do think that obviously there's a difference between running in a primary and running in a general. Obviously, if you're in the primary, you're trying to out-left the others, really attract that base of people who vote in the primary. But in the general election, you've got to appeal to a very broad base. And you have to also appeal to some of the people that, you know, voted for Trump back then. That's why, you know, talking about things like the dignity of work probably might be an appealing concept to folks, you know. Some of these things people are going to go, there's no way in the world the government can afford to do these things. It's just not possible. It would be great, but it's not necessarily possible. So I think that there's two things. Do you want to win the primary? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. But do you want to win the general election? You really have to be a successful candidate, you really have to figure out a way to do both of these. And to run in that primary, you're going to be driven to the left. So not, you know, not taking those super, super left positions is kind of a bold move at this point.
Thomas Wood, we have 30 seconds.
The electorate-selectorate conundrum is pretty well known. What will be interesting, of course, is if Trump decides to portray himself as a moderate for 2020, and I don't think that's something he's inclined to do.
Yeah, and Brianna?
I agree.
Well, that was efficient. I want to thank you, Brianna Mack, Assistant Professor of Politics and Government at Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Thomas Wood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Ohio State. Thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
And Jessica Wehrman, Washington Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks as always. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
You bet. And everybody else, thanks for the calls. Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. The All Sides staff, want to thank them as well. Producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Ray Brewster, Macy Glockner, and Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.